All right, we are back for another edition of the Fried Egg Podcast. Today, I hosted Kyle Franz on the podcast, and due to Kyle's graciousness with his time, we actually are going to split this into two parts to make it a little bit easier to digest. Thanks for listening. As always, if you like the podcast, please rate us and write us a review in the iTunes Store or Stitcher. And also, if you haven't yet, sign up for the newsletter that goes out every Monday, Wednesday, Friday. We write a lot about golf course architecture in it, especially on Fridays. We do this new deep dive portion. So if you haven't signed up for the newsletter, please sign up. And without further ado, here is Kyle Franz.
I miss a green, for example. I'm already upset. When I find my ball in the bunker, I'm really upset. And when I find my ball in a
fried egg.
Fried egg.
The dreaded fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg lie, I'm about ready to run off the golf course.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another edition of the Fried Egg Podcast. Today we are talking with Kyle Franz, a up-and-coming golf course architect. Kyle's most famous work has been his restoration of mid-pines down in the Pinehurst area, and he's also worked with many of the top architects and is currently consulting on restorations of many top golden age golf courses, including a Seth Rayner, a couple Ross courses, and a few Stiles Van Cleek courses up in the Northeast. Kyle, welcome on.
Thank you very much, Andy. Excited to be on. Can't thank you enough for inviting me on, and looking forward to chat about architecture the last week since we started discussing
Yeah, excited to talk with you. You got a wealth of knowledge and experience, and you know, having worked with all these different guys, including, you know, Coren Crenshaw, Doak, Gil, Hance, and you know, even Kyle Phillips. It's pretty cool that you've gotten to see so much.
Well, thanks, appreciate it. You know, I've been really very, very lucky in my career thus far, and hopefully we'll continue going the same direction. You know, certainly can't thank Tom Doak enough for the giving me the opportunity right out of the gates, internship at Pacific Dunes out in Bandon, and all the opportunities I've got from all of my mentors. You know, Bill and Ben at Pinehurst number two, and Gil working on the Rio Olympics course. A lot of really fun and interesting courses along the way, both from a restoration standpoint and new builds. So it's been a very exciting run for somebody who grew up wanting to go in the golf course design business, and fortunately everything has worked out thus far. So
yeah. So how did you get into design? Did you know at a young age this is what you wanted to do?
I did. Yeah. You know, I was as I've joked for many years, I was kind of like the ultimate golf kid growing up. My mom got me into a membership at a little public golf course, a little 1920s era golf course on a very weird piece of ground. Almost like, to make a long geologic story short, it had like these very long running ridges and valleys everywhere from a catastrophic flood that had happened eons and eons ago. And they had no real irrigation system in modern terms, anyway. It was one of my first jobs, was putting on couplers and fairways in the middle of the night. And but it gave me an appreciation for, you know, just good solid routing and fun, quirky architecture on wild, weird ground. And this was in Western Oregon, you know, a place where you wouldn't expect to find sort of an oddity from a land standpoint. You know, I just kind of went with it from there. You know, I really loved playing golf, and I played like 478 straight days once, actually, and just became, you know, interested in architecture. I think how a lot of people become interested in architecture. I think probably the difference is I really genuinely wanted to write from the very beginning. You know, I would get a hold of, old magazine articles, top 100 rankings, major championship previews, and I just pore over all the information. Went through Tom Doak's books at an early age, and then kind of got a hold of a lot of the old classics, and just kind of went from there with it. I really kind of decided during my high school years that it was something that I would really like to do, and I would meet people and just they'd be kind of amazed that I knew as much about architecture as I did for having never been anywhere as a kid. You know, I met some guys that had played at Pine Valley and were not far from there, and they actually sent me like a scorecard and a map of the golf course. So I would just absorb information, just like a lot of kids collect baseball cards, in your youth. And so I really wanted to go into it. I didn't really quite know how to do it. You know, I was working on the maintenance staff of my home course, which, again, it was a very limited budget sort of place. And I asked Tom Doak for a job at Pacific Dunes, and really begged and begged for it. And he was nice enough to give me a shot. I was studying turf management in school at that point, and didn't know whether I should jump into landscape architecture at Oregon or stay with turf at Oregon State. But it all kind of came in line for me when I worked at Pacific Dunes. It really gave me a very vivid understanding of the business and really what it takes to really do great architecture right from the get-go. It's obviously one of the best pieces of land that anybody's been handed in the last 80 years, Pacific Dunes. But What really I was impressed with was the level of detail. You know, obviously I knew that Tom was an exceptional designer, having read his books and followed his career through the 90s as he made the ascent to getting a project like that. But I was enormously impressed with the talent and level of dedication of the other guys that were on the project, like Jim Urbina and Brian Slonick, his associates. And the fact that, they also would kind of throw, a young guy like me out there to, give stuff a shot and to really contribute right out of the gates. It was a lot of fun because, I studied architecture so closely to an obsessive compulsive sort of level. But to get out there and Tom, let me shape this or let me, handle the grassing on that and just throw ideas, just a 19-year-old kid, but Tom was always absorbing ideas from everyone. He was fun to work for like that, and the fact that he always has, obviously, he's one of the best architects ever, so he always has a very strong vision for where everything's going and what he wants to do, but he'll just throw people out there and see if they come back with something better, and if it's good, he'll go with it, and if not, it'll come up with something better. So it was a lot of fun to work for Tom right out of the gates. It was kind of a surreal experience to be out there on my first internship and, just be standing there in a hole. He asked my opinion, just as a young guy, certainly well studied on architecture, but maybe not with the experience of having got to get out and visit and study golf courses just being a teenager. So, mm-hmm. So that's how I kind of got started with it. I started working for Tom and worked at Stonewall in Pennsylvania and then went down to Barnboogle Dunes and got to kind of expand my role on projects working down there. And it was really an amazing experience. I mean, working on two of the three highest rated golf courses built in the last 8 years was pretty crazy. Yeah. Like, oh, we're going to do this every year? And obviously it doesn't work out that way. But it was certainly a lot of fun, so I'll always be very appreciative of the opportunities that Tom gave me to get into the business and take a shot at it. Sometimes I think it's probably a lot of people who have tried taking this route have realized, the hardest part is almost the first getting your first opportunity at it. So
yeah, a lot of fun. It's that internship program Tom has is pretty cool to see how many of the young architects like yourself have come out of it. Getting that hands-on experience so early is critical to, I imagine, your development as an architect. So you mentioned playing golf 478 days in a row.
Yep, right.
When did this happen? And
it was when I was age 13, 14, I believe.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, somewhere right in there. You know, my mom got me this, you know, this membership at this little public golf course, and I just went and I just played every single day. And not all of them were like 9 or 18 holes, but I got it at least, you know, it's Oregon winter weather, Western Oregon. It rains a lot, but it doesn't snow very much. So so I just started playing and playing, and I think part of it is some point in there, I was like, oh, I got to keep the streak alive. I got to play 3 or 6 holes today. Yeah, we finally had a snowstorm, February of 95, that busted up the streak. So
that's when it ended with a snowstorm.
Yep, finally just couldn't go out there and do it. I probably could have snuck in one more day, but it was starting to spit with snow out there. I'm like, I think I'm done. It was a good run. So,
what did it feel like, right, like the first day without golf? Were you just not knowing what to do?
I'm just trying to think. You know, I think, when you grow up in Western Oregon, you know, it's kind of a novelty when it snows because it doesn't really do it very much because of the sort of moderated oceanic climate. So, I was probably looking forward to being a 14-year-old kid and just getting out and, you know, going out and doing some cookies with my friends in the car, something my mom probably wouldn't have wanted us to do. But joking aside, it was tough for my streak then. I was hoping that it was going to make it 500. So
That's crazy. I wonder what the longest streak anybody's ever had is. It's got to be close.
There's got to be somebody out there that's cracked 1,000. You know, it's amazing to me some of the folks at clubs that I work at. You know how dedicated they are out there every day, rain or shine. Does it make any difference? Who knows? It's a good question though.
Yeah, as I said, I grew up working at a club, and one guy, an older guy, show up the same exact time every single day. It was,
right,
it was like at 9:50, I'd have his bag on a cart, like ready for him to go to the range. Because right. 10
yep.
o'clock.
Those are the people that you really love to do this work for. You know, the people that really get out there and appreciate it. You know, the greatest golf courses in the world, you know, I've always made the analogy that it reminds me of how one of my professors in school described great writing. You know, that in great writing, there's not a word, a phrase, or any detail of the writing that isn't absolutely perfect. That isn't just perfect in literal terms, but it kind of takes it all to a higher level. And that's the way that I look at great architecture. When you think of, you know, Royal Dornoch or Pinehurst No. 2, the old course, every little hump and every little bump out there, you know, arrives at making it all nearly perfect. You know, you're always learning something about the golf course, so to speak, you know, and all the interesting shots you can find out there. And, you know, as designers, I always kind of, you know, take a step back and wonder, it's like, how much do people really, really notice the intricacies that we try and put into architecture like that? You know, I think that's one of the strengths of that I marveled at, you know, what Pacific Dunes was, the quality, the details, and trying to get it to, you know, that level, the fun shots around the greens, et cetera. You always wonder how much people really catch on to that sort of stuff. But you know that the people that play every single day like that and really, even if they're interested in architecture or not, they'll slowly figure out all those cool little things that we throw into the equation. So I especially really enjoy doing the design work for those kinds of people. You know, my favorite events here at Mid Pines Pine Needles are, they have the U.S. Kids in the summertime. And, you know, so the golf courses are basically invaded by, you know, 10 to 15-year-old kids for an entire week. And I always really enjoy it because I hope that the kids are as excited about what they see out on the golf course, Ross's great old designs and the work that we have put into restoring them, that they are really impacted the same way that I was when I was a kid, you know, in high school or before that, like the period that we were talking about. When I go to cool places, you know, USGA caliber courses like Portland Golf Club. You know, I really hope the kids enjoy it the way that I did going to those. But even just the people, you know, day to day that come and play golf at Mid Pines Pine Needles, you know, a guy by the name of Jay Mickles will become one of my best friends to play golf with. You know, he's an older gentleman, maybe 65 or 70 or so. And Jay plays every single day. He played all the way almost every day through the Mid Pines restoration. So he was always watching what we were doing, and I got to know him kind of through that. A lot of guys like that, whether it's, you know, Chris Bowie, the great rider of Ross's work, or Rand Morrison, who lives here in town. You know, those guys are always coming out and playing, and it's really fun to hear their feedback on the work that we do, and for them to enjoy it. You know, it's pretty cool.
So Mid Pines was, you know, kind of your first shot. You know, what was I guess not your first shot, but, you know, first like major restoration, and from all signs, I haven't been down there. Everybody raves about it, and first time it's ever been in a top 100 list after the restoration. Tell us a little bit about that project, and you know, kind of where the course was and where you've taken it to, and, you know, it you know, the things you learned during the project.
Sure. Well, how I got kind of started with it was, I obviously worked on the restoration of Pinehurst number 2, as we discussed briefly before, for Corin Crenshaw. So I was really, really, really in a good place to take on a project like it. You know, I did a lot of research in the Tough Golf Guys while we were working on number 2, and I was always noticing Mid Pines. You know, John Jeffries, Kevin Robinson, Bob Ferrum, you know, the Pinehurst maintenance guys had suggested I go see Mid Pines, since the greens had really never been changed very much. Only a couple greens that really kind of been tinkered with at all. So it was a great opportunity to go see Ross's original work here, since, you know, Pinehurst number 2 greens had obviously been switched to USGA greens at some point. So they've been reshaped, but they're still very close to the originals. But Mid Pines, you can go see what we call the final float, the final raking and perfect detailing of what Ross's style was exactly like. So I would come over and look at the golf course during the number 2 work, and got to know Kelly Miller and the Miller Bell McGowan family. Kind of get started just kind of talking about the golf course. You know, I'd found many photos of Pinehurst number 2 and the Tough Golf Guys from the 1920s and 30s. You know, the period when the golf course had been completed by Ross, and was really just very impressed with what I saw in modern terms, and especially back then. So I started speaking with Kelly about you know, the opportunity to try and restore it. They wanted to do a greens regrassing project and switch them from bent grass back over to reeder grass as they originally were. And you know, I just kind of started, you know, throwing ideas at them of what they could do. I did several photoshops of what the holes originally looked like. You know, re-adding the sandhills details. You know, the natural bunkers and sandy hardpan areas around the holes, which were such a unique feature that we obviously re-added with number 2. And I think they were pretty intrigued to try that as much as possible and would be practical for the course. You know, as I always say, it's kind of like Pine Valley, but playable for the normal person. Since it's not as you know, penal. You know, the ground is so much firmer here in the sandy areas. So, you know, we just kind of started talking about it, and they really liked the photoshops and my ideas for what the holes look like, or I thought they looked like, and started throwing together plans for it in that autumn of, I guess it was 2012, just kind of went from there with it. We broke ground just after Thanksgiving that year, and I think the thing that was most intriguing to me about the golf course is while it's the same general style as Pinehurst number 2 and Ross's work here, he tried to make all of the golf courses that he worked on here a little bit different stylistically. While the bunkers were all natural and rugged and had the sandy hard pan areas, you know, the overall style of each golf course is a little bit different from the other one. So I really, really worked hard to draft off of that, of his original concepts, and get them to work for modern play. So a lot of fun. You know, a lot of our of restoration architecture is one part design, and the other part is kind of archaeology and trying to figure out what was actually in the original designers' heads. And it's been a lot of fun to do that on all the golf courses that I've worked on here now.
I really want to get down to that Tufts archive. That's one of the cool things about Ross is how much of his work is preserved and kept in a singular place. I wish that was the case with more architects. In terms of, having worked with a lot of Ross courses, what would you say is kind of the most underappreciated aspect of Ross's design career?
Boy, that's a difficult question. I think for the fact that his design style varied so much during the course of his career. His New England work is completely different to his work in the Sand Hills, and in other portions of the country. I would say that for me, as a 30,000 square or a 30,000 foot answer to the question, I think the thing that probably is underappreciated is I think a lot of times when you sit down and watch a major championship that's played on a Ross course or what have you, everybody will hit on like kind of the obvious details. If they play at Oakland Hills, they're going to talk a lot about how severe the greens are. If they play Pinehurst number two, they're going to talk about how great the recovery shots are around the greens. What I always marvel at in Ross's work is his ability to have come up with the exact right concept for each hole on the ground that he's given. Obviously a great router of holes, always finding interesting ways to attack the landscape and find good green sites, find the right place to put the holes where it's a comfortable walk and all the holes are interesting and varied. But the thing that I really like the most about, especially his work here, is that he, again, he was just always finding the right answer for the design of a hole, given the ground in front of him. A great example is like the 17th and 12th holes at Mid Pines, which are two holes that are within 120 or 30 yards of each other, but they attack the landscape in two really interesting ways. The 12th hole is a mid to short of par four with a fairway that sort of slopes sharply from the right down to the left-hand side. The green is canted on a 45-degree angle as such that you really need to hit your tee shot on the left-hand side of the fairway. There's a big front right bunker that really makes approaching the green from the right-hand side of the fairway a nightmare. It's almost impossible to hold in some conditions. So what Ross did is he set up a tee shot where you could hit a nice big sort of swing draw that would sort of hit in the landing area and kind of bound down to the honey spot in the far left-hand side of the fairway, the side of the fairway that you need to be coming in from. Only, because of the orientation of the green, you wind up having hit this nice little draw down to the landing area. Then you really need to be able to hit like a straight shot or even like a little baby fade off of this hanging lie, where it becomes a very awkward shot. So the bottom line is the player that has all the different kinds of shots really has the advantage in the hole. The 17th hole is almost the dead opposite, but again, utilizing the same kind of concept where the land is gently going down and to the right in the landing area and the tee shot. So, a player that can hit a fade on the tee shot really has kind of an advantage. And then the second shot, there's just a big old hillside where the bunkering front left of the green that really really encourages you to try and hit a draw into the green site. Again, opposite, off of a kind of a hanging lie where the ball is going to be a little below your feet, and the tendency always is going to be to miss it from the right, far be it, let alone try and hit a draw off of. So, he was just always coming up with, I think, the right answer for a piece of ground. He's a great router, and he had just a real knack for finding the right concept for the hole, and you get 18 different looks all the way through. He was just really creative in finding the right answer, and then 18 in a row of them the right answer, all to arrive at a golf course that is really varied and cool all the way through. All of his best work, I think, has that kind of hallmark in the designs.
Yeah, that's the thing that impresses me most with Ross is the variety in his designs, but also, just how he created these subtle little features that, really good players notice, but for the average player, it's pretty easy to navigate, and they aren't worried about a hanging lie and having to try and hit a fade
into, you know, from a draw lie, they feel like they have a chance when they're in the fairway. So I think, you know, that is one of the things I think that's underappreciated with Ross.
Absolutely, you know, and you hit the nail on the head. All the things that I described are like grade A architecture stuff, you know, the stuff that is really good thinking man's kind of architecture. But the holes always worked really, really well for every skill set of player, you know, whether it was a player of his caliber, you know, he was at one point one of the best players, you know, in the country. You know, he finished in the top, I think, 10 in a U.S. Open.
Yeah.
But the holes always worked very, very well for the average player. And that's why, you know, I really think that he had is one of the best impacts of anyone in the history of American golf. You know, if you think about his work throughout his life, you know, having done that many hundreds of golf courses, you know, he made it possible to take really good sound architecture to the masses. You know, any little town that just wanted a cool little club, they were going to have it. And, you know, I think that I've always actually admired that about Ross. I think sometimes people have made the criticism of Ross that he took on so many projects and he took on so much work that it didn't have his hand in all of the designs. You know, it would have been impossible to travel around to do that in that day and age of train travel. But I actually think that that's something that I admire the most in him is that he didn't seem to have really an enormous ego. You know, he's a man from humble beginnings in Scotland and immigrated to the United States and built himself to have this massive business. So many employees at one point. You know, this at one point I believe I've heard that he had like 3,000 employees at extension. Just if you counted all the laborers on all the projects and everything that was going on. But you know, he wasn't afraid of if a golf course didn't turn out, you know, as good as Pinehurst number two. You know, when he was at his best and he was on the ground, he was capable of designing as good as anyone who has ever lived. But he wasn't really, you know, he didn't really have an enormous ego. You know, he wanted to do good golf courses that people could enjoy everywhere, and that's why I think that really he did have one of the largest great impacts in the history of the game in American golf. If you think about, you know, the most influential people in American golf, you know, obviously Bobby Jones and Nicklaus and Palmer and, you know, the impact that Tiger Woods has had in the modern age. You think about who's really next in line behind that. I think it's pretty obvious. It's always been pretty obvious to me is Donald Ross for all the golf courses he did in so many different states, so many different places. Again, he really brought good to great architecture to the masses in the United States, and I think that's
Like the agronomy.
Absolutely, you know, brought like the whole package to the equation. You know, his background of having worked on maintenance and you know, understudied for Old Tom and St. Andrews and Carnoustie, and then obviously growing up in Dornoch, you know, he was the full package. Mm-hmm. That's for sure.
So in terms of Ross courses, what would you say is the most underrated or underappreciated golf course in his portfolio?
Ooh, boy.
That you've seen, yeah.
Boy, I would really, really have to think about that one. Right. I feel like I probably would be cutting somebody off at the knees who deserves a bit more more credit. You know, there's so many good ones. You know, I mean, just a couple that come to mind is Mid Pines. I think it's a great golf course that really flew under the radar for a long time. I really like Plymouth in Massachusetts. It's a really cool course that kind of flies under the radar. But again, I feel kind of bad just sort of throwing those two out there because there's so many of them that that inevitably it's sort of like being asked, what's your favorite child? You know, you can't really do that. You know, I'm sure there's several great Ross courses that I still myself have never been to.
There's quite a few of them. So it's always a
that
good.
That really kind of gets back to the previous point is, you know, he left such a deep talent pool of great golf courses that some of them are still great. Some of them could use a nice little restoration like we did with Mid Pines and Pine Needles and there's just such a deep talent pool. Really very, very impressive.
Yeah, if you, I always look for Ross courses when I travel. If I don't know where to play, it's always like a good, you know, especially on the East Coast, or, you know, he did a lot in the Midwest. But like, if you're looking for a place to play, you know, let's see if there's any public access Ross courses, and they're, you know, a lot of them aren't in perfect shape, but you know, they still have such good, like, simple architecture, and it's easy to play, and they're usually very affordable. So, you know, that's always, I think a good way to travel.
Absolutely. And I think the one that probably jumps to mind, that it always amazes me that it stays as far under the radar as it does, and it seems to have taken a nice little jump in the rankings the last few years, is Essex in Massachusetts, you know, in Manchester by the Sea, up north mm-hmm. of the city. That golf course blows my mind. It's just such a cool Ross course, and you know, it always kind of amazes me. It's like, how is this one not a lot more famous? One that I also really like is a place that I went and just briefly did some work for Gil Hanset a couple of years ago. It's Saconnet in Rhode Island. Short golf course. I think it's only maybe 6,200 yards long, so basically pretty well preserved. Probably about what it was when it opened, and some fantastic views out over the waterfront, right along the shore there, and some really, really neat greens. I don't want to start quoting holes in case I forget get a number wrong, but there's some really, really neat holes out there, and some great over water views. This is a really neat golf course. That's where Ross made his summer office at, actually. He spent obviously his winters down here in the Pinehurst area, and then spent a lot of his summers up along the shore in Rhode Island. Really cool course.
It's a pretty good spot to spend summers at. It's that I've heard that my buddy has sent me a bunch of photos from there, and it looks so cool, and it's got a lot of little quirk, but you know, it's a shorter course, but it defends par because of those greens and just the subtle little design features.
Right.
Yep. So you know, having worked for, I would say, you know, if you said Gil, Tom Doak, and then Bill and Ben, you know, three of the most forefront architects of today. Tell us a little bit about, you know, some commonalities that they share that make them so great.
Well, I think the thing that obviously they all share is an appreciation for classic architecture and the do-it-yourself mentality. You know, the design-build philosophy. I mean, obviously all of them have a encyclopedic knowledge of great architecture and how they would like to approach it, you know, from routing on up and building really cool natural stuff or classical material. You know, I mean, anytime that any of them are deviating away from anything that's completely 100% natural, it's always going in an interesting, old, kind of quirky way. You know, I think one of Gil's strengths is his willingness and interest in building sort of like you know, classic New England architecture or classic English countryside architecture with a little more kind of quirky sort of, you know, stuff in there. But I think it all comes back to the general philosophics of they're going to get out there and they're going to build great architecture in the field with their own shapers, their own finish guys, and the hands-on approach to the work, you know. And they all go about that a little bit differently, you know. In the case of Gil, I can pretty much guarantee wherever Gil's at right now, it's on a bulldozer someplace. You know, I mean, that's his happy place, I think. I think he really, you know, he's a great architect, a great marketing architect. You know, he's so great in front of the camera, but I think, and he's so good with all the client and relations and all the emails and all the business of being an architect. He always amazes me how hard he works. I mean, he's a person that generally spends 10 hours a day on a bulldozer, and then he goes and he does emails and plans all night long. You know, it's very impressive. But that's why I think it's kind of his happy place, is to get out there in the field and build stuff himself. Whereas Doak was also a shaper back in his younger years working for Pete Dye. But he goes about the work in the field in a slightly different manner where, you know, he likes to sort of like walk around and hover over the proceedings and work on multiple things at once, where we can jump over to the guys working in this set of bunkers over here, or building these greens over here, and he has a very deep talent pool of shaping design associates that are perfect for that. They could probably all be designers on their own, but they are incredibly good shapers, and he utilizes that back and forth dynamic very well. Bill is the same sort of way, where he spends a lot of time kind of walking a property and throwing a bunch of different ideas around and coming up with what he really wants to do and what he thinks is going to work very well, and then he's actually on a sand pro at the very end of the process finishing the greens himself, which is something that Gil does as well, but that is really Bill's main kind of creative construction portion of the process. Is he field kind of directs the building of the green and then actually finishes it himself. So they all go about the work slightly differently, and I think that's the to kind of complete the point on Bill, he spends more time, I think, walking his projects than anyone. He's constantly on site and just kind of walking and throwing ideas around what he would like to do. So while the results come out in the end really very similarly, they all go about it in slightly different ways, but all of them rely on good solid design build theoretics and having talented staffs of guys to get out and do the work and are as passionate about architecture as they are.
I mean the design build concept just makes so much more sense to me than the contracted out. It seemed all the parties are aligned, and I don't know why you would draw plans and then hand them to somebody else to interpret your plans. Now I know it's not that simple, but it just seems like if you're doing the plans and you have the guys working for you, it's gonna there's one less person involved, and that's always a good thing when you're trying to do something special.
Absolutely, it makes sense, all the sense in the world across the board. And getting back to the beginning of the conversation, that's really what I learned right out of the gates from Tom. I knew what good architecture is, and I was able to contribute immediately because I had a good eye for things. But what kind of blew my mind is just how much he was out in the field, how much Jim Rubina, Brian Slonick, they were Brian was shaping every single day, Jim was in and out shaping this, shaping that. And these are, again, guys that could design on their own. The attention to detail was pretty impressive to watch and to see, and the creative process, just going back and forth in terms of discussions of what would happen, what was implemented. And that was the beauty of Tom, is that, he didn't care what the best idea was or who it came from. That's what was going to happen. That's why I was quite happy to ask, even down to a 19-year-old kid that was just a golf course and golf nerd, what I thought, and that interaction, that doesn't happen if you're just merely handing a set of plans to a contractor. You take a bunch of really, really talented people that know what's good and know what'll work, and you throw them all out there and just run it through the process and see what you come up with on the other side. I don't see how anybody could expect to get results that good merely from handing plans to a contractor. And the thing is not only is the design build philosophy better in terms of architecture, it's also a lot more practical for the client. The more that you're eliminating outside contracted costs, where things are either just not turning out very good or as good as it can, or they're having to be rebuilt multiple times to get it to all finally get to a good place in the finish line. It just expands the price tag, by eliminating the middleman and just getting out there and doing it yourselves. And I think that's, you'd have to ask Tom himself, but I think that's something that he realized that degree of craftsmanship working for Pete, and I think that Bill also did. And they had their own ideas about what they wanted to do that were slightly different from Pete, but they recognized the value of approaching the work like that, and they just kind of followed suit and even took it to another level of hands-on construction. And that's been, by virtue, it's been handed on to guys like myself who have worked for them. You know, I do my own shaping just like Gil does because I think it's the most practical way to go about it. You know, if I have a lot of different projects going on at once, I might you know, spend time jumping around, you know, field directing a little bit how I described Bill and Ben and Tom working as opposed to being on the machine like Gil is. But you know, again, it's the same difference. You know, I've learned how to be efficient and practical and save clients money while getting the right product. And I've even kind of, you know, kind of tried to take what I've learned from the strengths of all of their personalities and utilize it to hopefully wind up with good results myself. So I've definitely learned a lot from watching how they conduct themselves and the differences in their little styles that they utilize to achieve good results.
Yeah, I think that collaborative approach, I growing up caddying was like, you know, somebody I'd caddy for, they'd be at 18 handicap and they'd say something about the game of golf and it would like make a lot of sense to me. And at the time I was like a, you know, a scratch or better player. And like, that's the thing about, you know, just life in general, you can learn something from everybody. So having the collaborative approach on site, I mean, it's not going to hurt you, you know? It's
absolutely.
So you're currently consulting on, you know, a bunch of golden age courses. You're a golf nerd, as you say, just like me. And you've got kind of a vast array of architects. Like, in terms of golden age architects, who do you think flies under the radar? You know, whether they're a regional guy or that they're great architects that, you know, you don't hear as much about as like a Ross, a Tillinghast, or a Rayner, a McDonald.
Good question. You know, one person that I really don't think has ever really gotten their full credit and due with the quality of the work and all the places that they worked at, which was H.S. Colt. You know, I think that obviously he's a household name in architectural circles, but I think that most people sitting and watching a Masters telecast every year, they know all about Alistair McKenzie by now, and most everybody, you know, knows quite a bit about Donald Ross just for the iconic effect that he's had in golf and architecture and famous places like Pinehurst number two. But Colt, you know, all the different places that he worked at, is really an impressive list. You know, places where nobody really these days puts together a good solid lineage and understanding of the history of great courses like Muirfield, for example. You know, just how much of that was his design work, Colt's work there. You know, I think the more one digs into his career and history, the more one realizes he's a pretty smart guy with a lot of really cool work all over the place. Whether it was, you know, just his input at Pine Valley, but the same could also be said of you know, George Thomas. You know, I mean, being as amazing, he really didn't do that many golf courses.
Yeah.
I think that he doesn't really get as much credit as he should, even though the, you know, the work that he did at its best was some of the best architecture in the history of the game. You know, I think LA Country Club is a prime example. You know, a lot of people don't realize that his original concept for the golf course was it was essentially a course within a course concept, so to speak, where the golf course could be set up one day to play as like a really, really difficult, you know, par 72, almost 7,000 yard golf course, and then the next day it could be set up to play as like a quirky and crafty little par 69 or par 70, 6,100 yard golf course, and the architecture all worked at varying degrees in between. You know, so that you were getting completely different golf courses you could play the same day just by moving around the hole locations. That's what kind of made it all work, is You know, they'd set the short course and set a bunch of really wild, tough pins, and then vice versa for the longer course. But all while the architecture still worked, and the players had to really think about what they were doing out there, where they were trying to hit tee shots to get good angles into greens, and where not to miss greens. All the bells and whistles of great architecture, you know. So, generally a well-known, famous architect. You know, if you're going to go into more obscure architects, you know, one of the guys that we have talked about a bit, before the podcast, you know, A.V. McCann, who did a lot of work in the Northwest, where I grew up, is an American architect, really did some great quality work that I don't think people really realize how good it was. And a lot of it's the fact that, you know, maybe time hasn't really been as friendly to their work as it should have been. You know, a lot of his courses have been changed or too many trees planted or just the usual things that happen over the span of 100 years. You know, greens get changed, various things, all the things that happen. And then, you know, in the UK, I always really liked James Braid's work. You know, there's a lot of great Braid golf courses, mm-hmm. And there's also some neat ones that kind of fly under the radar. And I always found a lot of those to be some of the more entertaining golf courses that I went to in the UK. And a lot of them would be just kind of right under the notices a lot of the time of bigger famous places.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a couple examples would be there's a place that's really just up the railway line from Carnoustie called Panmure, which is a course that's kind of easily missed over there. The first couple holes and the last couple holes play across very, very flattish kind of farmland. But in the middle of the golf course, it all goes out into this very rumpled and wild little dunescape out there with some really, really sharp, crazy dunes, and the holes are really routed in a lot of interesting ways to arrive at some pretty unique holes. There's a couple holes on that golf course that I would put on my top, like, probably 50 holes in Scotland. It's just some really, really neat stuff out there. You know, a couple other places, Fraserburgh Golf Club in northern Scotland, it's kind of like that, where it flies a little bit under the radar, but there was a hole out there that I was inspired for an idea that we ended up using in the Olympic course, the ninth hole, where it was kind of inspired from a hole there where there was these two big mounds in front of greens where if the pin were kind of front right on the green behind the front right mound, you could actually sort of careen a shot off of the front left mound and curl it around the mound front right of the green. And then if the pin was on the left side, you could do vice versa. You could, if it was behind that mound, you could sort of curl a shot off of it, you know, just some really neat little wild, you know, Scottish architecture. Same would go for Barora up in the far north of Scotland, north of Adornoch. I'm pretty sure that's a Braid course as well.
Isn't that the furthest north course in Scotland, or one of them?
Not the furthest north, but it is probably the furthest north, like, really great, great course. Mm-hmm. Of the old architecture. It's about 20 or 30 minutes north of Dornoch. And, you know, for anybody kind of knows Dornoch, I mean, even it kind of flew under the radar to a degree through a lot of the 50s and 60s and 70s because it was so far to get to driving up there. You know, they didn't have the big bridges that cross the Dornoch Firth or those other firths that you have to cross to get up there. So you had to drive all the way inland, all the way back out, and all the way inland and all the way back to get to those places. So, you know, Dornoch kind of flew under the radar for so long that the places north of it, like Barora, you know, those have only become, you know, even in architectural circles, kind of household names the last 10 or 15 years. Even the Barora, that's one of the coolest golf courses that I saw over there. Really, really neat place right along the ocean. So those are, you know, some of the more obscure stuff that I have always personally liked in terms of both courses and architects.
That does it for part one of the Kyle Franz podcast. Part two should be posted within the next 24 hours. If you're listening to this after, just check out our website, iTunes, or Stitcher for part two, which dives into Kyle's travels through the Great Britain Islands, restorations abroad, as well as some listener questions and overrated, underrated.
Yeah.